I'm John Krall. May is Mental Health Month. On No Limits today, we're going to talk about the difficult and delicate subject of maintaining mental health in the workplace and in our work lives. We're going to talk about ways to cope with stress and maintain the proper balance in life. My guests are Dr. Suzanne Coyle, Executive Director of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center and President of the Indiana Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and Dr. Christina Davis, Clinic Director, Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at wfyi.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. May is Mental Health Month, and today on No Limits, we're going to be talking about mental health in the workplace. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Dr. Suzanne Coyle and Dr. Christina Davis. Dr. Coyle is the Executive Director of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. She's also the president of the Indiana Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Dr. Davis is the clinic director for the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. And presumably, since we try to be a friendly program here, we can all operate on a first-name basis. Suzanne, Christina, welcome very much to the program.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you here. I want to start because it struck me as I was thinking about this conversation that mental health is one of those things, at least in the popular perception, that we often define in its absence, that by what it is not. So I'd like to start a little bit by arriving at a definition for what we consider, you know, mental health. What is something, what are the characteristics of someone who is mentally healthy? And I'll start with you, Suzanne.
I think that's a great question. And I would begin the answer by saying that actually when one is mentally healthy, you really don't notice anything about them. Mm-hmm. It's the absence of negativities, dysfunctional behaviors, the ability to be resilient in different and difficult situations.
Okay. Christina.
Yeah, I think that everyone has their baseline. And so sometimes it's very difficult when we talk about what is normal to define that. And sometimes it is a deviation from what is considered healthy and functional for an individual. And when they're not operating in that way, it's usually a signal that something is going on.
So is the baseline different for everyone that you referred to? Christina, you're nodding your head up and down. Nodding your head up and down works well in a personal communication, not so much in an audio medium like this. So, yes.
Yeah, I do think that the baseline is different for everyone. And I think that certainly there may be some of my colleagues that may hold even more strictly to a strict diagnostic code for what is health and what is dishealth or unhealth. But I do think that some are perfectly fine and have really fulfilling lives and relationships. And and if it's not causing them harm or others harm, a lot of times I don't think that that's diagnostically significant for something that's a mental illness. And sometimes culturally that can look very different. So I tend to look at what are those differences in baselines and what is the deviation from that.
So what are the signs, then, that someone is not mentally healthy, that that there are problems? Suzanne, I'll start with you on that one.
I think some of the common sense kinds of symptoms that you might notice with friends, family, or coworkers would be around the area of picking up on what Christina said. We always have some kind of radar, if you would, about a baseline, about how our coworkers, since we're talking about in the workplace, usually function. Some of our coworkers are a little more erratic than others, and that may be kind of a norm for them. Others are really calm and stable. And then when those kinds of people exhibit erratic behaviors, whether it's things like just being overly agitated over an event at work that doesn't seem to be a big deal, or if they really are exhibiting kinds of factors like always getting to work late, taking too long a lunch hour, being not focused, not getting the level of work accomplished that they normally did, a decrease actually for the workplace in productivity.
There's a question that occurs to me as I listen to the two of you talk. I mean, is it, since the baseline is sort of what is the norm for a particular person, I mean, does everyone start out mentally healthy, or are there some things that lead, that are inherently, signs of mental illness, incipient mental illness? Christina, I'll go with you on that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that some mental illness can certainly be traced back to early childhood development. So when exactly that happens is sometimes difficult to pinpoint, but certainly perhaps as long as someone has been an adult, they've known themselves to be this in such a way, and it may be something that's considered a mental illness. And I think there is evidence that some mental illness has genetic predisposition at the base of it. So there are ways that can be something that's just with a person. And whether or not it's activated or not, sometimes you can be genetically predisposed for a particular mental illness, but it's really not really evident or active until a actual event occurs and it's something that comes up. So I think that it's a both and. It could be with us from the very beginning, but then it could maybe not even show up until something, an event occurs.
Are some of us more predisposed toward mental illness than others? Suzanne, I'll go with you on that one.
That's really the research in terms of some of the genetic predisposition that Christina referred to. There's also the whole context of environmental and family contributors to mental illness. And being a family therapist, sometimes, well, I would have to change that and say always, we develop certain coping mechanisms that serves us well in the families in which we grow up. Then, oftentimes, when we end up marrying someone who comes from a totally different family, some of those coping mechanisms really are deadly for that relationship, and it also carries over into the workplace. And so, it's, I think, really critical for people to be able to have their own barometer, if you would, about how they grew up, how they are different in terms of other people, and so forth. And there's also an issue about the communities people grow up in. If people grow up in communities that are impacted by poverty, it's a tougher life. And so there are certain kinds of coping skills you learn when you live in those kinds of environments that really do not serve you well when you may be in another kind of community context.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace. May is Mental Health Month. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we are talking about mental health in the workplace here, and since we've sort of established a baseline for what we consider mental health now, how many challenges, I mean, is the workplace one of the primary stressors, one of the triggers for mental, at least challenges to mental health? I'm trying to avoid using the term mental illness here. Is the workplace, and if so, what are some of the things that serve as triggers? I'll start with you on that one, Christina.
Sure. I think this question of stress is one of the primary ways that work life can impact one's own mental health. And, you know, those are sometimes the environmental factors that someone could be going along and it's never really happened to where they've had to deal with a mental illness until just the right amount of stress kind of sends them into that space. So stressful work environments can be detrimental to one's mental health. So really long hours that one's worked, as well as really high demands for productivity. And some of those can be, of course, externally imposed. Sometimes they're internally imposed, where we put some pressures on ourselves. But certainly there's a mind-body connection. If folks are having a lifestyle where they're not able to eat healthily while on the job, exercise, rest well, these all impact our mental health as well. So to the extent in which there's a good work-life balance, sometimes that really helps.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Marcia, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I have a question about a sister, a family member who has some type of mental illness. She has severe anger issues that flare up at odd times, and we've struggled with it forever because she can get so angry and then disappear for 2 years. Like, we don't hear from her. She moved one time cities and didn't let us know, but then she'll come back in like everything is normal. And my other sister, there's three of us, we just don't, we're 50s and 60s, we're not young anymore, and we're about to have this happen again with her, and we just don't know if there's any support systems like Al-Anon for alcoholics, or is there any place to get some help if you have a family member that has, and she will never say that she has anything wrong, but it's clearly a type of mental illness as far as we can see.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Marcia. We'll see if we can get you an answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Suzanne.
Yes, there is an organization called NAMI. N-A-M-I.
What does that stand for?
It's National Association National Association for Mental Illness.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I have to get my acronyms right. Good mm-hmm. thing I have Christina here to help me out. So, and they have a lot of meetings across the city. Mm-hmm. All you would have to do is go to NAMI.org. Mm-hmm. We, in fact, have a group that meets at the CTS Counseling mm-hmm. Center, mm-hmm. and it's a support group for persons whose family members seem to have a mental illness. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would just say is I think it's really critical that you'd be able to try to get your sister to her physician as a beginning point, and then try to make some kind of connection with a qualified mental health professional.
And I think we're going to get into that subject of how you deal with a person who is showing signs that he or she is not mentally healthy, and some of the behaviors are difficult. But specifically for Marcia here, you say you have these support group meetings at CTS. When are they, and is there a charge for taking part, Christina?
No, there is not a charge. So these are meetings that anyone is welcome to. And the group is really, we've got a few counselors who facilitate, but it also really emphasizes peer support. I think currently they're meeting on Monday evenings. Those times, kind of depending on who's in the group, sometimes shift. But certainly you can check out our website at cts.edu.
Go ahead and give that to them again.
Sure, cts.edu, and look under support groups, and you can get a list of that support group as well as others that we have operating at this time.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace. My guests are Dr. Suzanne Coyle and Dr. Christina Davis. They're both with Christian Theological Seminary's Counseling Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. May is Mental Health Month, and we are talking today about mental health in the workplace. My guests are Dr. Suzanne Coyle, who is the executive director of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center and president of the Indiana Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and her colleague, Dr. Christina Davis, who is the clinic director for the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. We've gotten an email question, and I should say if you want to reach out to us via email, you can do so by sending your question or your comment to nolimits@wfyi.org. This email question is, my wife finds it distressing working in an organization in which workers frequently gossip about other workers. In fact, she particularly is bothered by supervisors talking about their supervisees and group situations to other supervisees, as well as to others generally. Could your guest please address the mental health issues and consequences of this sort of situation? Christina, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty tough position to be in, particularly as a partner concerned about their partner at work. And my guess is that he gets to hear about all of that when she gets home and shares how that's distressing. And I think that, you know, poor boundaries at work are not uncommon. I think almost in a method, in a way of coping with some of the stress and anxiety at work, it can seem as though to join with a person and talk about how bad things are going or talk about another person, it takes the attention off of what people feel most frustrated about, and it puts it on something else. And it's a form of coping, but it's not a very helpful one. And so I would just encourage this person to think about how they can connect with coworkers around common interest, around things that they enjoy talking about that has to do with the two of them that are in the room, or the three, rather than talking about someone who's not present. It's a very easy thing to get caught in, but it really doesn't help a work environment be a healthy one.
What is the best way to deal with, and I'm not sure this question applies exclusively to the workplace, because obviously you can find these sort of stresses. And I want to pick up a little bit on Marcia's question. What is the best way to deal with, you know, someone who is exhibiting signs of, you know, not particularly good mental health, or, you know, other forms of sort of emotional dysfunction? Marcia's sister, we were talking about sort of disproportionate outbursts of anger and all of this, or even these kinds of behaviors where you know, there's almost a maliciousness to the talking about, you know, other people in the workplace. Should you confront people on this? Should you remove yourself from the situation as best you can? What's the coping strategy there? Suzanne, I'll start with you.
I think your response varies as to whether it's your family or a friend or whether it's the workplace. I think you have limited possibilities for a response in the workplace. My suggestion is to always try to eliminate yourself, even if you have to physically move when there is gossiping going on in a workplace. Because although it may feel really great that you're bonding when you're complaining about another coworker, if someone is complaining about that coworker, it's quite likely they're complaining about you when you are not around. So I would suggest in the workplace that you really try to focus upon your own job. Another option is that when people try to get you involved in gossip, to just make a clear statement in a non-defensive manner, something to the effect of, I understand you have some concerns about this person, but I really prefer not to talk about it. And then go ahead and do your work. If it's a family member or a friend, I think what you always want to do is to try to talk with the person directly, one-on-one, and to not start a conversation with, you are really acting crazy lately. That's not a helpful thing. But to say, I'm really worried about some things I've been seeing. I love you so much, and I want the best for you. And these are some of the things I'm seeing, and I'd like to better support you.
Are there situations, you know, with this email question, people are gossiping or complaining or whatever, in which that is appropriate or acceptable or okay? I mean, I'm thinking I did not have supervisory responsibilities in my own career until I got into my late 30s, early 40s. And I'd always been part of the group and then realized there was a time after that when I had to supervise people, that you'd walk up to the gathering and all the conversation would stop and suddenly you'd have a pretty good idea who and what they were talking about. And my wife would ask me if it bothered me, and I'd say, well, at first it did, but then, you know, I realized Americans by and large have a God-given right to complain about the boss, and that you just have to accept that and roll with it. And there are some decisions, I mean, a decision will always have a cost, that people are going to be unhappy about. They do have a right to complain in those situations. That's not necessarily a sign that they're not mentally healthy. Christina?
Right. And I think that, so two things that you said there is, yes, I think it is actually important to express oneself as a sign of mental health, right? So to have healthy outlets. And so to the extent in which people can have an experience that they're upset about and find healthy ways to talk about it, even to vent. I think where it crosses over to maybe something that's not helpful is when it's no longer productive and you get kind of the opposite effect where it keeps persons from really feeling better after all the complaining or after all of the expression, they're no better than they were before and they can't kind of get out of that rut. But the other important thing that you mentioned there is that there is a difference between stress and being upset or being angry and mental illness. So I think it is important to name that it's healthy to have a wide range of emotions without being pathological in that way.
We have an email question from a listener, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. This question's a good one. It says, what are the indicators of a sociopath, and what can an individual do while working for a boss with sociopathic tendencies? I've read studies that indicate more sociopaths end up in supervisory roles than non-sociopaths. How can healthy individuals navigate this type of destructive personality? Suzanne, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, the email writer must have that experience at work or else has watched a lot of sitcoms on TV. Mm. And there's a reason there are sitcoms on TV, because it does happen. oftentimes what really drives a person to move up the ladder is that they are good workers. But sometimes there's a very different kind of set of skills between someone who's a good worker and very productive and being a supervisor. And oftentimes in the workplace, there's oftentimes not enough good training about how to be a supervisor. So I don't know about the research on whether most supervisors and bosses are sociopathic or not, but I do think that at the bottom line, it's all about whether or not your boss really seems to care about what's going on with you and really tries to listen. Someone who would quote-unquote be sociopathic in a cultural definition would be someone who really does not care what happens, is really rather self-centered, doesn't have much of a moral compass about what occurs and so forth. So,
how does that differ from, say, a narcissistic personality?
Well, they're quite different, and I certainly don't want to get into diagnosing everybody over the airwaves, but someone who's narcissistic has a sense of grandiosity. Mm-hmm. They have a sense of right and wrong. Someone who's sociopathic really does not have an internal moral compass, for lack of a better word.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace because May is Mental Health Month. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Rev, welcome to the program.
Thank you. The comments about complaining and gossip, I think, introduced the subject of CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy. True or false? I wonder also, I've heard and talked to people in that field that CBT has more or less replaced old-fashioned Freudian psychoanalysis. To exaggerate a bit, psychoanalysis is used to treat very wealthy narcissists who have a lot of money and need somebody to listen to them. And CBT is used in sleep disorders, weight reduction, and depression. Over and out. Thank you.
Thanks much, Rev. Suzanne, I'll let you respond first.
I think there are a lot of different kinds of approaches to address workplace stress and so forth. Basically, it's quite different than being in therapy. So what really happens, there's a whole new genre of approaches called coaching, where people really learn different methods to work with people in terms of supervision. I do think that one thing you do not want to do in the workplace is to try to do just therapeutic kinds of techniques on coworkers, but rather if there really seems to be a need for counseling, to refer them to the workplace, the organization's employee assistance program. Most employers have those at present, or you could actually pull together a whole list of referrals if it's a really small workplace and you don't have that kind of option for employees.
Gotten a tweet, a question via Twitter from a listener named Shannon, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Shannon says, what needs to change about workplace culture when we say we support people with depression, but employees fear admitting it? Christina, I'll start with you on that one.
Yeah, I think there is sometimes a divide between what we say is important and then how we actually put our actions where our mouths are and make sure that we actively support folks if and when they do share that they have any type of struggle, and depression included. So, you know, I think that the culture is shifting slowly but surely. I think that even the fact that we have a May Mental Health Awareness Month is one indicator of that, that we're saying that it's appropriate to be talking about these things. They are important and they matter to us. I think a few things that you could do in the workplace is to even think about as an employer, incentivizing folks getting mental health checkups in similar ways that some organizations are recognizing that physical health is important, and they incentivize that because they know that it's connected even to the bottom line and productivity, but also, happy workers are workers that that are loyal and that remain around a lot longer. So I do think that that's one way to shift the culture. And I think, one in every five adults has had a mental health concern within the last year. So given that, we do work, if not ourselves being that person, we do work with folks with mental health concerns. And so it's really recognizing that this is something that impacts pretty much every workplace and every family. So we all know someone. I think that this sense that it's only one person is just a myth that we've got to do better with.
What, and I want to pick up on this point, I'm going to take it in two directions. What, if anything, do businesses, not-for-profit organizations, basically employers, owe their employees who are dealing with mental health issues? I mean, what is there an obligation there, moral or otherwise, Suzanne?
I think there is. There are some statistics, I think, that's really enlightening about the breadth of this problem in the workplace. Most research indicates that one in four persons name work-related stress and depression as their biggest stressor. So that's a huge number. There are other statistics where employees will say it's something around 75% that they wish that their employer would provide workshops, seminars, resources to help them deal more efficiently with stress. So the other quality that hopefully employees will recognize is there are statistics that say that businesses in America lose $23 billion a year due to absences and lowered work productivity from employees who have depression.
And then I'm going to take it another step, because we tend to, when we think about a business, we tend to think about something that is impersonal or an organization or whatever. As colleagues, what do we owe each other when we see someone who is struggling with a mental health challenge? Christina.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to name that we spend more time oftentimes with our colleagues than we do with our own family or friends that are not coworkers. And so a lot of times these are the folks who we would consider our friends, that we would consider we would be the first one to notice if something was different because we see them just that much. So I do think that we have, when there's a relationship there where you're seeing your colleague at work and you might invite them then to, out to eat afterwards. I mean, to the extent that you have that relational connection, that certainly it should follow then that you would be concerned if you notice that something was not well with that person. And I think it is appropriate to say something. Now, there are some colleagues that maybe you don't have that type of closeness with, and you would have to think about whether it's an appropriate thing to do. But I just think that many people do see their colleagues as people they truly care about, and I think it would follow that you would say something if you're concerned.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace. May is Mental Health Month. My guests are Dr. Suzanne Coyle, who is the Executive Director of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center and President of the Indiana Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and her colleague, Dr. Christina Davis, who is the clinic director for the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz toll-free at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, and you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. May is Mental Health Month, and today on No Limits we are talking about mental health in the workplace. My guests are Dr. Suzanne Coyle, who is the executive director of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center, as well as the president of the Indiana Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. She is joined by her colleague, Dr. Christina Davis, who is the clinic director of the Christian Theological Seminary Counseling Center. We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, some employees seem to crumble at the mention of improvement or constructive critique on the path to improvement. What is the best way to navigate sensitive personalities in the workplace? Suzanne, I'll go with you on that one.
That's a great question. I think that one thing that employers can do is to really be proactive before the evaluation comes up about setting a tone in the workplace, about the reason for evaluations, trying to get employees to understand that by getting feedback about specific skills that need to be improved, that they can do better in their jobs, they can possibly go forward and get promotions and so forth. So it is a touchy kind of question. I think sometimes all of us, as we hire people, need to really also think up front about what are some of the guidelines you're looking for when you interview people, about trying to match that individual's personality with the environment in the workplace.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about mental health in the workplace. May is Mental Health Month. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
NAMI stands for National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. It's a wonderful support group. If someone was going to be an enlightened supervisor or boss and they had an EAP program in their workplace, oftentimes it is a very good idea to suggest that maybe the employee should visit. You know, they can do it very privately. So that cuts down things like gossiping and stuff. But it's a way of reaching out one-to-one and helping your employee.
Well, thank you very much for the call and the information.
Welcome.
Thanks, Debbie. Okay. So what are some other proactive strategies? I mean, obviously, you know, you've got a problem if you're dealing with this after, you know, some of the behaviors that indicate not particularly good mental health. What are the things we can do to foster, either in ourselves or in the environment in which we work, that we can foster good mental health? Christina.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that, you know, it really can't be skipped that if you really are struggling with a mental illness, that there is treatment, that, you know, you don't have to just kind of figure it out on your own, and that there is effective treatment. And so I really do encourage that folks do see a professional. I think EAPs are wonderful resources. If your employer doesn't provide something like that, you might have an insurance company that you can call and ask them for referrals and who's in network, and kind of find something that's affordable that works for you. And you can also, for some that might even not have insurance, there there's a website, Psychology Today, that you can look for a therapist and kind of get some recommendations from friends. I mean, there are resources out there. There are ways to connect. Of course, the CTS Counseling Center is a wonderful resource as well. We offer counseling for families, couples, individuals, and we offer them at reduced rates based on kind of income. So we have the sliding scale. And, you know, I do think that there is help out there. So my number one suggestion would be to really be connected with that.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace. May is Mental Health Month. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Darlene, welcome to the program.
Yes, my name is Darlene. I'm a dual-year, and I'm actually a student at SCCS. I'm a counseling student and also I'm a dual-degree student. And my question is, how can the church be equipped to deal with type of issue of mental health? Because I know in the past we usually associate mental health problems, either the devil is doing that to the person, they don't really see it as a mental health problem. So how can we address that? How can the church be equipped to learn to deal with such a problem?
Thank you very much for the call and the question. Suzanne, I'll throw that one to you first.
I think the church is increasingly doing a better job in different places about this issue. And I think that's being influenced by persons like Gerlene herself, who are receiving training and are learning more about the ins and outs of mental health. I think what's critical in a congregation is also to do a lot of education in the congregation, to maybe open up the church for AA groups, for NAMI groups to meet, to also include in sermons a normalization that it's okay to ask for help. That's a huge piece of things. And I do think that more and more mainline denominations, as well as evangelical denominations, are including a heightened kind of sensitivity to mental health.
So, how much of this is a challenge of just getting many of our institutions, the church, businesses, anything, to destigmatize mental health? I mean, it's acceptable for us to call in and say, you know, I'm not coming into the office today because I've got the flu or I've got a cold or whatever. It's not nearly as acceptable to call in and say, I'm not coming in today because I'm depressed. Mm-hmm. You know, and how do we go about breaking down those stigmas? Christina, I'll start with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that one of the things is that if someone is calling in, or even if they're struggling with depression, I think it's important to know that it's not something also that kind of just passes on its own or goes away like the flu or like a cold. So I would just hope that folks would be, again, kind of connected with resources so that this is something that people are continuously supported in. I think that perhaps that is one of the reasons that it can get a bad rap, that if you call out for not feeling well one day, as Suzanne was referring to earlier, that if it's not being addressed in a more kind of direct way, those call outs are going to become more chronic and they are going to become more of a frustration for your employer. But if you can say, hey, I'm dealing with depression and I need to go to weekly counseling sessions, or I need to adjust my schedule this way so that I can make sure I take a walk after work. And so if you come to your employer with a plan, I think that it also helps for the proper management of that information, rather than both persons kind of not knowing what to do to work together to address it.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about mental health in the workplace here on No Limits. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have a question. You were speaking about the sociopath, and I know of someone that has been considered a sociopath or diagnosed, and let me use that word. What kind of environment or bringing up or what would cause that to, you know, have that kind of behavior?
Thank you very much for the call and the question, Debbie. We'll see if we can get you an answer. I mean, it sounds like we're back at that where we started this conversation about to oversimplify the whole nature versus nurture discussion about how much of, you know, this is shaped by just who we are, you know, the electricity and chemicals and all of that make up our thought processes, and how much of it is shaped by our experience and the things that we learn along the way. Christina.
Yes, it's an age-old question about kind of nature versus nurture. And what we are understanding more is that there's really just this interplay between the two that's very difficult to separate. Nature does impact even how one is nurtured and how one receives nurturing, and vice versa. So nurture and how we are biologically impacts how we received other things. So environment impacts us biologically, and biology impacts our environment. So, I kind of hear underneath the caller's question, and I might be reading in between the lines a little bit, but, you know, was there something that somebody could have done or could not have done to have caused someone to be a sociopath? And a lot of times it's not something that simple. It really is not. That a lot of times it is this commingling of factors. Yeah, and so I would just really encourage people to also not blame oneself if and when, like I said, we all might encounter mental illness in our own families and in our own lives.
Is there recovery? I mean, there seems to be a fascinating. We've gotten several questions here that sort of relate to this, you know, sociopath, the supervisor theme. If one is a sociopath, and I realize there are probably, you know, there are, you know, there's a Ted Bundy level, and then there are levels below that, considerably below that. If one demonstrates sociopathic behavior, is there recovery from that, or when the break is complete, is it there forever? Suzanne, Christina, either one of you.
Well, I do think you're right to say that, first of all, a lot of sociopaths are very charming. So there are these images that we see, or we think that they're all criminals, and not so much. A lot of them are kind of fully functioning out in the world, and you may never really know. But also to say that, yes, I mean, there are folks who, through treatment or through their own process of awareness, that they've been able to kind of function in the world and not have a whole lot of adverse consequences to that tendency. Now, I do think that it is a tendency that may never go away. So the sociopathic tendency to maybe think about how will the situation benefit me, or maybe to not have that ability to empathize and understand when someone else is being harmed because of your own actions. But I do think that people have learned how to manage that and live with that in ways that have worked for them.
Got a question, and this is a tough one, from a caller who didn't want to go on the air. And this person is a manager, has an employee who has some issues, not sure how to approach her, and the employer is afraid he or she is going to disrupt the employee's life if the employee is let go. Is there any advice to make that? I mean, obviously, no one looks forward to being fired or losing a job. Is there any advice or any counsel as to how you can make that a less painful experience for people and disruptive? Suzanne.
I think there are a few things that you are able to do. If the individual has a human resources department, you can consult that department because they're trained in this area and have some skills about this. However, if it's a small business, you may very well not have human resources department. There are, however, people who do consultations with family businesses, small business, who either are independent human resource persons or are coaches or consultants and so forth. And you could contact someone in that arena. I do think that clearly before you fire someone, you want to make sure you're doing all the legal things you need to do. But I think the main line is that of trying to have a clear conversation and then being able also to have some resources for that person if they are indeed fired.
Got a related question. What should be done about coworkers with substance abuse issues? Christina, I'll throw that one your way.
Well, you know, that one is, I think it's also one where it takes quite a bit, I think, to really share with a person that we're concerned about you or that I'm concerned about you. With substance abuse in particular, there is quite a bit of denial that comes along with substance abuse to say that this is really not a problem. I can stop anytime. I just don't want to stop is sometimes the response is there. So I think it's important just to kind of give observable, objective kind of observations about, well, you know, you used to get to work every day on time, as Suzanne was kind of saying earlier, and we're noticing that you've been late several days this week, and just kind of just try to be objective in a very concerned and compassionate way to help lift up a mirror to help someone see what it's very difficult to see. But there are, again, very effective treatment and recovery models for substance abuse. And, you know, and to get people hooked up with those resources is the key.
We're getting close to the end of the program here, and I think it would be, if not irresponsible, borderline irresponsible. If somebody has been listening to this and is suffering from depression or some other challenge, and they want help, who should they call? Is there a number that or a URL? Suzanne?
Well, you certainly could call our counseling center. We could make a contact to see what might be appropriate.
Could you give the number?
Yes. It's 317-924-5205. That's 924-5205.
I'd like to thank both of you, Christina Davis and Suzanne Coyle. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
Is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.